Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning, welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. And we do get to play some rather cool music as well. You got Julian Pauly live in the studio. No PG today, I'm afraid, but later in this hour, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, we've got Phil Muffett from the Mexman Swinton Astronomical Society talking about all sorts. Maybe latest on his observatory's building in his garden, noctilucent clouds, maybe even the book moon. And if he's swatted up, he's going to be talking about super puff planets. Exciting stuff.
And Jodrell.
Oh, yeah, Jodrell Bank. Forgot about that. Yeah. Ooh, big news that this week. Right, first up, though, we're going to remind you of the Big Butterfly Count.
Yes, the annual UK Big Butterfly Count started on Friday, 17th of July, and it finishes next Sunday on the 9th of August, 2026. This helps to assess the health of our environment by counting the amount and type of butterflies and day flying moths you see in a 15-minute period. So if you go to www.bigbutterflycount.org, and there you'll find how you can do it. We've had quite a lot.
And even if you see nothing, that's just as important for the records.
And we also had to save one. We got in our car, we had to get it out.
It didn't fare well. No. But never mind. Next up is an interesting little snippet, if you like. Lithium is the lightest metal and the least dense solid element on the periodic table. But because it can hold a lot of energy in a small space, it is a key commodity for renewable energy. Lithium is in high demand at the moment due to increased interest in battery energy storage systems, data centres and the infrastructure needed to support artificial intelligence. Despite this, there are fears of a glut in 2027. Last month, the Chinese electric vehicle battery giant CATL, or C-A-T-L, was granted a permit for its mine. Next up, Paul is not looking.
Yes, because I'm busy doing something.
You're having to work, aren't you, this week?
Yeah, I've used both hands. Yes, so Johnson & Johnson, or as we know, J&J, has offered to pay as much as $5.5 billion, or in our money, £4.14 billion, to resolve tens of thousands of lawsuits in the US, alleging that its baby powder and other products containing talcum cause ovarian cancer. J&J has denied that its talc-based products cause cancer and has changed the formula of its widely used baby powder. Talc is a natural mineral made of magnesium, silicon, oxygen and hydrogen, known for its soapy feel and often used in baby powder. Talc is mined from the earth and is found in seams close to that of asbestos. Well, I didn't know that. Which is a material known to cause cancer.
Thanks to our Chris for highlighting that story. That's been going on ongoing for a while, actually. Meanwhile, fossil fuel companies have downplayed the extent of their methane emissions for decades, according to research by the Centre for Climate Integrity, which also reports that major gas fields in the US could be releasing far more planet warming gases than is being officially reported.
Sorry to do this one, but and as wildfires rage in southwest France, 16% of rivers across the country are reported to have dried up, another reminder of the consequences of extreme heat and drought. The Loire, France's longest river, is at an historic low. Any of the Seine, which supplies drinking water to Paris, is on life support. But this morning, the river doesn't seem pretty.
Well, it's not good, is it?
Uncle said that our
reserves are better than maybe some other parts 80%. Of the country, which is like the south east in water hose pipe bands, aren't they? But elsewhere in the news, and this is another story to do with France, but a bit happier. No, this is a really interesting one, I thought. Scientists in France say they have discovered the building blocks of the incredible diversity of bird song. A team analysed more than 100,000 songs from 3,000 bird species and revealed that they are all composed of 8 fundamental types of sound that the researchers call motifs. Each song is made up of combinations of these motifs. There are 3 types of trill, 3 types of whistle, plus chaotic notes and harmonies. Birdsong is one of the natural world's most sophisticated forms of sound-based communication. And lead researcher and University of Saint-Étienne PhD student Quentin Backwell said the diversity is huge, and if you go to Asia, Africa, Amazonia, you will hear totally different songs. In this new study, he and his colleagues used a global database of birdsong made up of recordings uploaded by thousands of volunteers. And this meant the research team could analyse about 116,000 songs from more than 3,000 birdsong species. They studied patterns in the songs, how each song shifted and changed through time. And with the help of artificial intelligence, they could then compare the thousands of songs to each other to find what connected them. The scientists said this unveils the simplicity underlying the spectacular diversity of bird songs. A key finding was that the environment the birds evolved in, from tropical forest to temperate landscape, shaped how they composed their songs. So birds adapted for tropical forests use different acoustic building blocks or motifs to those from temperate regions. Simpler motifs like flat whistles are often found in tropical environments, apparently because they help the birds make themselves heard through the busy biodiverse soundscape and dense vegetation. More complex compositions with ultra-fast trills and combinations that contain lots of information are more common in temperate forests, where birds tend to communicate at closer range. Fascinating. And the next story is a fascinating one as well.
And whilst watching grass grow may not sound like much fun, well, at the moment there's no grass growing at all.
No, there isn't.
All brown. Only the weeds are growing at the moment, flora grass. Scientists in Hertfordshire have been doing it for 170 years, and that is watching grass grow. Queen Victoria was on the throne when Rothamsted research founders Sir John Bennett Laws and Joseph Henry Gilbert began studying a field near Harpenden to find out how fertilisers and manure affected hay yields. That field became the Park Grass Experiment, now the world's only experiment on permanent grassland, covering just under three hectares. It is divided into various plots treated in different ways. So scientists can compare how nutrients affect the growth, soil and diversity of grass. The research project was started by Joseph Henry Gilbert and John Bennett Laws in 1856. That work now includes techniques that could never have been imagined when the Victorian experiment began. Scientists can now use DNA analysis to study what has been living in the soil over time. Together with weather records collected on site, they give researchers a rare long-term view of how the environment has changed. The experiment had, for example, captured the impact of nitrogen and sulphur, which once fell on land across the UK, had effectively fertilised it from the air. But in recent decades, we generate our power differently. Our vehicles are powered differently, and the amount of nitrogen and sulphur that has been deposited on the land has therefore been drastically reduced. The project was originally started to monitor hay yields. As the experiment moves into its next century, much of the focus is now on climate change.
It's a fascinating one, that, isn't it? To think that, because of nitrogen and sulphur, because of what was in the environment, that actually fertilised land. So I thought that was a really interesting study. And finally, an analysis of Google Trends, I found this one interesting as well, by the language learning platform Preply, shows that UK searches for Learn Greek have risen by 550% in a month, reaching about 6,000 monthly searches after the release of Christopher Nolan's adaptation of The Odyssey. I think in the press it says, is that the real Odyssey?
Thank you.
cracking track there from Aphrodite's Child, Aegean Sea. And of course, they were from Greece, and that's why we played that track, Any Excuse. So we're talking about the rise in people searching for Greece because of Christopher Nolan's adaptation of The Odyssey by Homer, but not a lot of people like it in the sense of the translation, I don't think. But there you go. And if you've never listened to the album 666 from Aphrodite's Child, that precedes Dark Side of the Moon, of course, by Pink Floyd. It's well worth a listen. Incredibly interesting.
Yes, it's track. Got on bass. It's got
Demis Roussos
on bass and vocals,
and of course Vangelis
on keyboards.
Yeah, but both late and great. But well worth listening. But of course, you are listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, talking about science in all its different forms. Every Saturday morning from 11 until 12. Next up, very interesting article in the Sunday Times last week. It was written by Sean Linton, who's the health editor for the Times. Test on MND drug that could help 97% of sufferers. Human trials are to begin for a drug that could treat almost every person diagnosed with motor neurone disease, or MND. Scientists at University College London have developed the drug, which helps the body to produce a protein necessary for communication between motor neurone cells and muscles. In almost all cases of motor neurone disease, this protein is lacking. The drug is not a cure, but if the trials prove it works safely, it could be one of the first new treatments in years. In motor neurone disease cases, neurons begin to degenerate and die, causing a progressive loss of speech, movement, and even breathing. At any one time, 6,000 people in Britain are suffering with motor neurone disease. 6 are diagnosed every day. Sufferers can expect to live for 2 or 3 years on average, but some can die within months. There is only one treatment approved for use on the NHS. It's Riluzole. That's Riluzole, which can help to slow the disease's progress, but does not work for everyone. Motor neurone disease's profile has grown with the diagnosis of celebrities and sports stars. Last October, the former England rugby union captain and World Cup winner Lewis Moody, he announced he had been diagnosed after a persistent weakness in his shoulder that did not improve after physiotherapy. The Leeds Rhinos rugby league player Rob Burrow was diagnosed in 2019 and became a leading campaigner for motor neurone disease research, raising tens of millions of pounds. The Rob Burrow Centre for MND opened in Leeds in November, funded by a 6.8 million campaign. He died in June 2024, aged just 41. The Motor Neurone Disease Association is among Britain's top 10 funders of medical research, committing £10 million a year for the past 2 years. The initial research at University College London, or UCL, was funded by the association and the State Medical Research Council. It discovered low levels of a protein called UNC13A in motor neurone disease patients, caused because of a malfunction in the cells that means it is never properly manufactured. After the discovery, University College London helped to form a company, Trace Neuroscience, to develop the research and treatments. The drug it has developed is called TRCN1023, a small strand of synthetic genetic material that is taken into the nucleus of the cell. It is not a gene therapy and so does not alter your DNA, but once inside the nucleus, it enables the cell to properly manufacture UNC13A. The lack of this protein is thought to affect 97% of motor neurone disease patients, making it a crucial target for potential treatments. So Professor Pietro Fratta from University College London's Queen Square Institute of Neurology and co-founder of the company said, "Our research at UCL uncovered just how central this protein is to the disease process. Seeing this discovery translated into a clinical trial is a major milestone. Phase 1 has been authorised and 2 early clinical trials are set to begin within weeks, with recruitment of about 30 patients. Interestingly, trial sites will include the NHS Trust running Sheffield Teaching's Hospitals, so this is a bit of a local story as well, and University College London Hospitals. The drug will be injected into the spinal cord, which allows it to reach the central nervous system where motor neuron disease causes damage. So that's a fantastic article from Sean Linton there, health editor of the Sunday Times, and that was in last week's paper about a new drug to treat motor neuron disease. It doesn't cure it, but it helps it, all being well. Next up.
Right, yes. I was thinking about the song Sugar, Sugar.
This is another story that our Chris sent in.
Yeah, scientists at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology have suggested that eating very little sugar up to the age of 2 may help protect the brain decades later. The research, which was published in the journal Neurology, looked at nearly 65,000 people taking part in the UK Biobank and analysed the impact of the end of sugar rationing in the UK, which led to a rapid increase in the amount of sugar in people's diets. The results suggested those who were toddlers during sugar rationing had a 23% lower risk of dementia. The study, however, cannot provide definite proof, but experts say a healthy diet is good for the brain anyway. Yes.
Yes, indeed it is. And another very, very interesting article I saw in the press. Put your allergy on your travel insurance. It is holiday time, of course. This was an article by Rachel Mortimer. And it said, failing to disclose a food allergy to your travel insurer will invalidate any medical claim for a reaction abroad. Holidaymakers have been warned. The Allergy Centre of Excellence and Advice Service said that medical treatment for allergies is particularly expensive in the United States and Canada and may push up the cost of travel insurance in those countries. The number of people suffering from food allergies in England doubled between 2008 and 2018, according to Imperial College London. Hospital admissions for food-induced reactions tripled between 1998 and 2018. Last year, the Food Standards Agency said that about 6% of adults in the UK have a clinically confirmed food allergy. So James Gardner from the Allergy Centre of Excellence said food allergies are generally treated as a pre-existing medical condition by travel insurers, so you're expected to declare them. Multiple insurers warn that failing to disclose allergies can invalidate claims related to allergic reactions. He said that mild allergies that can be well controlled would add little or nothing to the cost of insurance premiums. But severe allergies, especially where the sufferer has multiple allergies, for example asthma, regularly has to use an EpiPen or has a history of anaphylaxis, shock or hospital admissions, are more likely to increase the cost. It is important to check the small print of a policy because each insurer will treat allergies differently. For example, travel insurance provided through an American Express credit card does not automatically cover food allergies. But travel insurance, for example, through an HSBC bank account does automatically cover allergic reactions, provided there's been no hospital admission in the past 2 years. The same principle of disclosing allergies applies to private medical insurance. Brian Walters from the broker Regency Health said the diagnosis of allergies is often covered but not the treatment. If allergies were known about at the point of application and not declared, this would be treated as a non-disclosure and the claim denied, though this would not apply to claims for conditions not related to that allergy. So that's a really interesting one. If you are taking out travel insurance and you have any allergies, you must make your travel insurance company know.
But that's as long as you know which allergies you've got in the first place.
Well, a lot of people do, don't they? Yeah. So it's maybe something you don't think about until you get caught out.
Yeah, I always found that sometimes when we flew on planes, nuts were not allowed to be eaten because somebody had a nut allergy, which is quite a weird thing.
Well, it is, but it's because the air's circulating in a small
you think,
space.
Oh, come on, that does. But yes, it does.
It does indeed. So, good advice there.
We'll be right back.
Great track there, very early track from Simple Minds, 1980. I Travel. We played that because the importance of declaring allergies on your travel insurance. So there you go. Listen, of course, to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every week. We should have Phil Muffett on the line.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you round the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquers of the sky. My heart would be a fireball, a fireball.
Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Good morning. And how are you, Phil?
Okay.
Are you fighting fit?
I wouldn't say that.
You sound better than you did last time I spoke to you.
Thanks.
What's up with your knee then?
I got bitten by an insect.
You're joking.
About last week, and it were all right first day, and then all my knee swollen up. So I've had like a band of pain around my knee. And it's like it hurts, and then it's gone down, and then it's flamed back up again.
You need to take antihistamines, I would suggest. Yeah.
Toxic insects.
It's toxic. Yeah, your body obviously don't like it, or it don't like you. it's probably died that insect now. But anyway, Phil, for people who don't know who you are a member of Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society.
That's right.
I know, msas.org.uk. You've got a great Facebook page, a great website. You're very active on social media, and last week, I know it was a bit cloudy, but you do a lot of public events, don't you? And you had one at your observatory.
I think we had 12 people to. I was somewhere else. But yeah, it was quite cloudy. I think Paul said the sun started to come out as everybody were leaving.
Oh, no. Well, that's astronomy for you. Well, or looking at the sun, isn't it? Yeah, you're dependent on the elements, aren't you?
Although this year we have had some rather good nights. I've actually photographed Neptune 2 nights ago about 2 o'clock in the morning. I didn't realise what time it was up.
Oh.
On my phone, Neptune was a good target, so I managed to get that. And the previous week, I actually photographed, well, actually a couple of weeks ago now, I actually photographed Pluto from my patio.
Wow. Is this with your newly built observatory?
No, it's not finished yet. This is just on the patio with my telescope I usually use.
Oh, you're breaking up a bit, Phil. I know you're under the stairs, aren't you? That's why you're breaking up. You've been banished.
In my office.
In your office, sorry.
Yes, it's surprising what you can photograph now. It's amazing. And I never imagined I could photograph Pluto from my back garden. Just bear in mind, it took me about 20 years to find Pluto, to discover it. And they had a 13-inch reflecting telescope and astrograph, specifically.
You're still breaking up, Phil. We might have to put you in kitchen or something.
Sorry, I'll move. Yeah.
Oh, so you can hear door opening now. He's coming out.
Yeah.
Dog will start barking now.
Yeah. So,
That's better.
There was a big telescope. And hours of catching pictures, so I managed to photograph Pluto. It took me about 10 minutes, and I did it with a 3-inch refractor from my back garden and a digital camera.
Wow.
So things are looking up.
Excellent. And this is all down to your equipment you've got now, isn't it, your setup?
Yeah, which is affordable to most people. It's all amateur gear, but it's stuff you can readily buy. So I tend to use Skywatcher and ZWO equipment, but there's lots of stuff out there now you can buy. Celestron have got some really good gear as well. So yeah.
Wow. So what else is coming up in the sky then, Phil?
Well, the big thing this month is going to be the solar eclipse, which is going to be on the 12th of August. So it's the summer holidays, and it will be late in the afternoon.
Wow.
So as the sun's starting to go down, about 6 o'clock. You really need some you want a solar filter so you can look at the sun, because obviously it's really, really dangerous. And don't look at it optically without some proper filters. We tend to use BARDA filters and hydrogen alpha filters. And that starts about just after 6 o'clock. Maximum is about 15 minutes past seven. And then as the sun's setting, it comes out of eclipse, the last bit of the moon.
Wow.
So off the sun as the sun's setting about 8 o'clock. So if you've got a good view of the horizon, you should be able to see the eclipse right down to 8 o'clock in the evening.
Amazing.
But it's about 90, over the UK, it varies from about 90% to 95% coverage. So there will be a point as the sun's going around down about 7 o'clock, you will see the sun as a crescent. But like I say, you want to be very careful how you observe the sun. You can still buy BARDA filters and solar glasses on things like Amazon. You might be able to get some from bookshops as well. Bookshops usually sell like film that they're like a cardboard glasses with film inside them, so you can look at the sun. I've got two pair. I've also got some discs with filters in, so I can hold the disc up in front of my face so that I can see the sun through the... It looks like aluminium foil, but it's not aluminium foil.
Wow.
But just make sure you get the right materials. You want to buy it from a reputable place.
I was going to say, you know, you buy stuff off like Amazon, you've got to be careful that it's the right standards, haven't you? Health and safety standards.
I've bought one off Amazon and it works. You just need to make sure, read the spec, make sure it's okay. Just be careful.
So where's the 95% coverage then? Which part of the country is that going to be?
The further you get down to Cornwall, the more coverage it'll be. More in Scotland, well, more on the east coast, the less it is. But it's actually starting up in Greenland, coming over Iceland, over Reykjavik, and then it's coming, I think it'll catch the west coast of Ireland, and then it goes over France and Spain. So some of our lads are going down to Spain.
Oh, they? Is that because, well, somebody lives down there anyway, don't they?
Yeah, well, he just missed out on the, well, the fires were right up to the bottom of his garden.
Oh, good grief.
Last week. but apparently a lot of the infrastructure has melted.
Yeah.
Pipes, cables, all that kind of stuff. So, but his house didn't catch fire.
So,
I don't know how they're fixed at the moment, but yeah.
But isn't that an interesting story? I mean, we'll probably talk a bit about Mambers Lake at some point, but this extreme heat, you know, yes, that's affecting lots of things, isn't it?
It's going to be interesting to see how warm the lake has been this year, because the last 2 years, the lake average temperature has gone down by about a quarter of a degree, whereas the reckon world temperatures went up by a quarter of a degree. And the previous years, it's gone up and up and up by about a quarter of a degree each year. So I think this year, although it took a hit over the past 2 years on temperature going up, I think it will have gone up considerably this year.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, we've had four heat waves and we could still be having some more through August.
Yeah, but when you talk about this guy, you're one of the members in Spain, infrastructure melting, you know, that country's not that far from us.
No. Well, we've started having fires already
in
the UK, and it's serious things. These things set people's houses on fire as well.
Yeah.
So it's a real thing that's happening, and people need to be aware. And it's things like cigarette butts and barbecue fires.
Yeah.
People really need to be vigilant because
it's tinder dry, isn't it?
Dry.
It is.
My garden is...
Not a garden anymore.
It's all yellow.
It looks like a field. Hey, but that's one of the things they're saying in future. We're going to have to forget this business of having lawns because they take a lot of water, don't they? But there you go. But going back to this solar eclipse then, for your club, this must be exciting news. You'll all be trying to get pictures and stuff.
Yes, well, when the sun gets low to the horizon, I don't think we'll see it come out of partial eclipse. I think we'll lose it in the trees at the back of Hoover Stand, but we'll be able to see the start and the main part of it for sure. So a couple of us are going up to the observatory that are left in the UK to work.
Have you? That sounded a bit sad, Phil. Like
no,
everybody's gone and they've left you behind.
No, I'm all right. I'm okay. Somebody's got to man the pumps. We will be having our observatory open, so if we do get any people passing by.
Really? What day is that, by interest?
I think it's a Wednesday.
Is it Wednesday? Wow. But did you know that was coming then, that event? Or was it a bit...
Oh, yeah. You know, these things are planned like years and years, if not decades, in advance.
So you knew it was coming and you get that. But what happens if it's cloudy and all that business?
Well, it will definitely go dark. In fact, it'll be unusual because of the sun setting and it goes into eclipse, it'll start getting darker. And then as it's coming out of eclipse, it'll start getting lighter before the sun sets and it goes darker. So it'll be really unusual. And it might be unusual to see how the wildlife are affected as well, because a lot of birds roost during eclipses. So if they think it's getting dark, they might start roosting, then wake up again.
Yeah,
and then go
it's
back to roost.
It's weird, so, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, that can be that time of in an evening.
Brilliant.
And then after that, there's a new moon, which means there will be no moon in the sky on Wednesday night, Thursday morning.
Oh.
Which means for once, the Perseid meteor shower, which will peak on Wednesday night, Thursday morning, there won't be a moon. So if the sky is clear, we should get a really good meteor shower.
Does that often happen then?
Over the past decade, we've had a lot of gibbous and full moons on the Perseid meteor shower, but it's kind of moved around this year so that we're getting a new moon, so it won't actually be affected by the moon.
So Wednesday evening could potentially be very, very exciting.
Yeah, parents with children that are interested in astronomy, you're going to get a partial solar eclipse, which is going to be good, and you're also going to get a meteor shower at night time. Now, let me just say one thing. Don't go out early. You want to be out after 10 o'clock. You won't be seeing meteors before 10 o'clock. So I'm thinking you want to be out about 11 o'clock. Perhaps get you a couple of deck chairs set up in the garden in a circle. excuse me, I've got a dry throat. In a circle so you can see a nice piece of the sky, basically generally straight up. If there's any street lighting, like I have, I stick a pole up at the bottom of the garden with a big sheet of cardboard on it, and it casts a lovely shadow onto my garden now so that I can actually block out some street lighting. It looks a bit weird to the neighbours.
Yeah, but they used to you. They used to you, aren't they, Phil?
They used to me being weird.
Not
to. Yeah, especially when they see what's going up in my garden next.
Oh,
anyway, that's another story. But yeah, you can actually do some shading in your own garden from street lighting. So if you have got something, a bright light source, try and block it out with some cardboard from Amazon.
Brilliant. But you know,
loads of packaging coming with Amazon.
That's been massive. One thing about having it's been warmer, so that's been one thing. You're able to be outside late at night and probably not think, well, I'm freezing.
Yeah, I've been out in my shorts and t-shirt regular. Last month I was out with bare feet on the patio because it was that warm.
Yeah, it's
I think the first time I've been out doing photography in
it's bizarre, isn't it? Have you still got your hot tub then, or you packed that in?
I've got my hot tub, yes. I've got the hot tub. We've only used it a couple of times this year, though.
Oh.
There's a water shortage.
Hey, there's a water, yeah. Well, there isn't a water shortage.
Exactly.
But...
And electricity is really expensive at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. But so you recommend, you need to be comfortable, don't you, viewing the sky? So as you say, you need to be
deck
reclined,
chairs,
don't you?
Reclining deck chairs are really suitable. You might need a blanket if it gets a bit cold, just to cover your legs up or whatever. But the other thing is, don't have bright lights knocking about. If you have a torch, put some red tape over it or something.
Oh.
I've got a small little flashlight, and I've got like a little red housing that shoves over the front, so I've got like a nice dimmer light. It doesn't impede your lighting. So when you go outside from the kitchen, your eyes will take about 15 minutes to get dark adapted. But what I would do is I'd get set up in the evening after the eclipse and just lay back and enjoy the sky.
Brilliant. What colour are they going to be then, these Perseids?
Well, green, orange, white, perhaps a touch of red, perhaps a touch of blue. It all depends what the makeup is. But these are small, rocky meteorites that are coming into the atmosphere. Anything from the size of a grain of sand up to a pea size, or even the really brighter ones, perhaps the size of a grape or even a tomato. So they tend to be that kind of size, and you get nice bright ones as well. So you want to be looking really overhead.
Yeah. So for kids, so, if you are going to let your kids do it, there's a lot of science in that, isn't there? In the colours of the meteors. Is that that's to do with the minerals that they're made of, yeah?
Yeah, the other thing is you can do is get, if you've got a DSLR camera, that you can leave your shutter open, put your ISO stop in on something like, I don't know, about 800, and get a tripod or lay it on a table upside down so it's pointing straight up. And you want it so it's shooting for about 30 seconds or a minute, and then take another exposure. And if you're lucky, you'll get a meteor shooting above your frame, and you'll be able to look at it later and print a picture off. Meteors look really good on camera, especially when you've got the stars in the background as well.
So 13th of August, then, your social media pages are going to go berserk then, aren't they, with who's got the best photographs. Is it going to be Spain as well for the eclipse? Is it going to be here?
Yes.
Ooh, rivalry, eh?
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting, and middle of this month's going to be quite interesting.
So let's talk quickly about the stag moon, because we need to talk about Jodrell Bank. That sent shockwaves, hasn't it, around? But
So the stag moon was the other week, so we've started calling these moons different names. It's the Americanism that's come through to the UK. So historically, we've not done that, but kind of picked it up from the Americans. So, yeah. And I forgot what this one's going to be called. I had it on the tip.
I thought it was a book. No, that's the stag one that's just happened.
That was last month. I forgot what it is.
But you've got to think, because you're part of Manvers Waterfront Boat Club, which is in the, well, it's, is it Rotherham? Is it Doncaster?
It's right on the edge of Rotherham.
It is, isn't it? So they, you have a moonlight swim, don't you, for every full moon?
The swimming section, yeah, they get about 100 people turn up.
Wow.
And do a lap of the lake. I think it's about a 400-metre swim that they do.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And but it's all controlled, isn't it? We must say that.
Lifeguards. Yeah, well, at the moment, it's about 21 degrees. So it's really, really good for a swim. But we do have lifeguards.
Yeah.
We have a safety boat, and there's people on paddle boards in case anything goes wrong.
Yeah, because there's been a big problem this year, hasn't there? The high temperatures, people going swimming. Thinking I'm just going to have a dip, but if you want to do anything like that, do it safely.
Well, we can't keep people out of Manvers Lake, because as soon as you've gone, they just go and jump in. The only thing I can say is, if you do go in water, don't go in water out of your depth. That is the best advice I can give you, because you'll never stop people going in to cool off. So stop in your depth, and then
and don't do it on your own.
Yeah, one of the things that they've taught us at Woth is, when you go swimming, what's your escape plan? And the problem when people die is they get in the water, there's no escape plan, because they've either not got anybody with them, or they're not suitably dressed, or have the right equipment. If our swimmers go in the water in bikinis or whatever, or trunks, they have floats with them, and it's a rule. If you come unstoke, the thing you've got to do is self-rescue.
Yeah.
That's the key. So the thing is, don't go out of your depth.
No. As you say, have a float with you, or even a life jacket.
Yeah. It's not a shame thing. It's a safety thing.
Yeah, no, exactly right. Unless, because we haven't sailed for a while, but first thing you get to realise, if you haven't got a life jacket on and you fall in the water, you don't automatically come back to the top. With a life jacket, it brings you up, doesn't it?
No. And it's a lot of people go paddleboarding, don't have life jackets. If somebody sneaks into the lake that's on a paddleboard and they haven't got a life jacket, we instantly know they're not members.
Yes.
Because the members are not allowed in the water without a life jacket on.
Excellent advice.
But anyway. Yeah.
But so Jodrell Bank, tell us, in the news this week, I couldn't believe it. So it says the government is not going to fund it anymore, so it looks like it might close in April 2028.
Nothing's clear. So the thing is, originally they said they were going to get a 10% cut in funding. That's from the UK Research Innovations Agency, which I think is mainly funded from the government. But I think they're wanting to fund some other projects. I think they've got a large radio array that they're going to be building in South America and South Australia. Now, I don't know a great deal about that, but obviously it's going to cost a lot of money. So it looks like, because they haven't got enough money to fund Jodrell Bank, they're making one big saving. However, it's also funded by lots of other things like Manchester University. It's also got National Lottery Heritage funding, and there's also four other foundations that fund it as well. So while the UK Research Innovations Agency is going to pull 2.8 million out of Jodrell Bank, basically, not give them anything.
Oh,
it's like they are going to be shortchanged, but I don't know how much the facility takes to keep it running. So they might be able to keep it running, but not do stuff that we want to do. But it just shows the country is in a worse situation than what we think it is. Because if we can't fund an international observatory like Jodrell Bank, there's something seriously wrong with this country.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
But so, as you say, Manchester University fund it, so maybe the government or the other funding bodies think private companies maybe will stand up, or university institutes will stand and say, we'll save it.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, let's hope so. So at least I've got 2 years to find funding from somewhere else.
Yeah, I think I read April 2028, is it?
Yeah. So the other thing to consider is Jodrell Bank is the third largest steerable telescope in the world. It's the largest one is in Green Bank, Virginia in USA. And the second one is the Bad Münsterfell Observatory in Germany. Both of them are 100 metres in diameter. And then the next one is 76-metre Lovell Observatory. And then they all drop down to 70 metres in diameter. There's a Goldstone. There's one in in USA. There's a Canberra one in Australia. And the Spanish have got a 70-metre, I think they call that the MDSC. And then the only other radio dishes that are bigger are the Arecibo radio dish in Puerto Rico, which is now defunct because it collapsed. So that's no longer usable. And then there's the Chinese one, I can't pronounce it. That's 500 metres in diameter. And that's in a mountain, and it's only got the secondary antenna is steerable, not the main dish. So Jodrell Bank is like a world-leading observatory. And without it, science in the UK is going to take a serious hit, and throughout the world, because people come from all over the world to use it. And we're also part of Merlin, which is a seven-dish array all around the country that combine all the information using interferometry. So they effectively make a dish that's like the size of the country.
Wow.
The UK. And it's also part of the Deep Sky Network, which means we also receive radio signals from satellites like Voyager that's right out on the edge of the solar system. So what they do is they link the biggest ones up around the world. So effectively the radio dish is as big as the world because they're in three different sections, three different points. So you basically make a circle as big as the Earth, so that you effectively, your radio gathering information is much, much larger, but you don't get any bigger. So it's all part of that. So it's actual fundamental piece of equipment. It's basically, if we shut Jodrell Bank down, it's like having an aircraft carrier out of an aircraft. There's no point.
Oh, do you know, and I thought they'd refurbed it recently.
They have. I've been this year.
Yeah, I was going to say, and it's on our list to go, and it's like, hey, because we've not been for years. And that's, so they put a lot of money into it and made it better and better, and now they're like having the rug pulled from under the feet.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is, it also employs thousands of people, and there's thousands of students go through Manchester University that use that facility. And there's not just one radio dish. There's the Lovell one, which is Radio 1, and then there's Radio Dish 2, which is a smaller one. I think that might be about 40 metres across. I can't remember now. And they've also got some other smaller ones on site as well. But, I mean, they're studying black holes, pulsars, all kinds of stuff. But they also use it. Don't forget, they can also use it for the military, which they have done in the past. They spied on the Soviets and they eavesdropped on the Americans. So when the Americans went to the moon, we were actually listening to them from England. So, and there's other science satellites that's up there in space that we also use it for. There's loads of things. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like getting rid of your TV at home. You wouldn't do it, would you?
You wouldn't. But, you know, I think there's a lot of controversy about cuts in science funding. It's not just this, is it? It's other bits and pieces across the country that people seem that are fundamentally important, but the government's saying, or the funding bodies are saying, we're not going to fund this anymore. And yet, as you say, they want to go and fund something in South America or Australia maybe instead.
Yes. Well, yeah, they're saying they want to fund things that are going to be long-term. I mean, I think Juddleback's been going for 60 years, and it's constantly been refurbished. So it's still cutting-edge technology. So don't think it was built in 1957 and it stood still, because it's continually been evolving and adopting. And they're still coming out with new ways of doing things. So the science isn't done. It's not a finished project. It's something that's still ongoing and it's evolving. And these are the brains of the future that are coming out of Manchester University.
Exactly. And I guess it's not just Manchester University. Will it? Yeah. It'll be other universities tapping into that.
Yeah,
that absolutely. Resource. And on things that are ever evolving and never finished, how is your observatory in your garden, Phil? Yeah.
So I've built the floor walls and I've got a flat roof with a big circular hole in it. And I've now got some plywood to build a dome. So this month I'm going to be
busy.
A dome.
Busy. So this dome, is it going to be able to be opened?
Oh, yes, it'll be like a traditional dome, 4 feet in diameter, and then there'll be a slit in the middle with a sliding roof that kind of pulls back on top.
Oh, and why do you need a dome? And not flat.
Well, one is, it takes me a good 15 minutes to get my gear out, set it all up. Then I've also got to polar align it, get everything working properly and focusing and everything aligned up, and then I can start shooting. So I can take 15 minutes off my setup time. Last night, it looked really, really good. I got my gear out. Left it outside for 2 hours, and then when I went out about 11 o'clock to start doing some photography, noticed there were some clouds coming across. I managed 10 minutes of a 30-minute photo session, and the clouds came in. I had to stop. So I'd spent a considerable amount of time getting ready for a 10-minute exposure of one object. So I managed to get a gas cloud in Cygnus, but I only got a third of the data I wanted. Now, with an observatory, when it's set up, I'll be able to go down, open the lid, turn it on, it'll be ready, and I can get straight into using. So I can probably cut my time down to about 5 minutes. And then when the clouds come over, I can just pull my roof over and I can shut it.
I like it.
So it's saving time, it's setting up and taking down. Bearing in mind, it's heavy equipment. I think my weights that I use on my scope are all 5 kilogram weights. Yeah. So I've got about 15 kilograms plus my telescope. It's like I can't just pick it up and move it. I've got to take it to pieces and reassemble it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The idea is it will be more convenient to use, and it'll just be easier to use.
But
the other thing is, it will keep light off my equipment, because I've got this constant threat of street lighting shining onto my equipment and ruining my images, because if your light glances into your tube, it bounces down, and then you pick it up in your camera and it dilutes your image.
Do you know what? I'm going to write to Rotherham Council. We've had enough of this, Phil. I'm going to send them this podcast and say, look what you're doing to him. But you know what I was asking? Why are you putting a dome on it? Why isn't it a flat roof?
Well, if it's a flat roof, I've got your telescope has got to go down inside. A lot of people do have flat roof runoff observatories. Well, I can build a dome. So the thing is, it can stay erected inside.
I just couldn't think, like, why would you have to have a dome?
So the top will slide back in a curve, and I've got an aperture to look out of. The other thing about a dome is, it keeps the frost and the wind off as well as the light.
Does it?
The people that have the runoff roofs, all your gear's exposed to the elements because your roof disappeared. Well, I'm putting a desk in mine. I'll be able to set my laptop up and have electronic equipment in there. And because I've got a dome and a flat roof, it will be protected from the elements, so I'm not going to get frost.
Amazing.
I'm not going to get wind or light, so I'll be in kind of, it's half flat and half a dome. So I've got kind of better.
I bet in there you're going to put heating in there, get a bit of wallpaper.
I'm thinking of one of those hot tubes that will just give off a few degrees.
Brilliant.
Just to stop things freezing up. But I don't want it too hot, obviously.
Yeah, for your equipment. But
it's only 4 foot by 6 foot. I kind of spent a lot of time working out how small I could have it. And it's like everything's brilliant. Kind of...
We've got 10 seconds left, Phil. Amazing. Yeah, are you going to patent your design for your observatory? Because everybody will want one, won't they?
Well, I hope so. It's just, it'll take you 3 months to...